We're delighted to be joined today by Dr. Ngozi Arondu, Technical Director of the Global Institute for Disease Elimination, on this episode of our hashtag Winning Women in Africa series. To celebrate International Women's Day throughout the month of March, Invest Africa has been hosting a podcast series, hashtag Winning Women in Africa, to promote inspirational African female industry leaders. Dr. Ngozi is a trained infectious disease epidemiologist with 15 years of experience working to improve health systems and global health governance. Her policy expertise includes strengthening regional leadership in pandemic preparedness and health security governance reform. Through Dr. Arondu's thought leadership and scholarly activism in global public health, she champions shifting power in global health development and empowering equitable research and funding partnerships. She has given lectures at over 60 universities, civil societies, and business forums on the importance of equitable inclusion in global health and publishes widely on the topic. She is the co-chair of the O'Neill Institute, Lancet Commission on Racism and Structural Discrimination in Global Health, and the technical director of the Global Institute for Disease Elimination. We're really looking forward to speaking with Dr. Arondu today to find out about her journey to achieving success. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Arondu.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Please, could you give us an overview of what the Global Institute for Disease Elimination is and what your role as technical director encompasses?
Yes, of course. So the Global Institute for Disease Elimination, and we go by our acronym GLIDE, we're here to advance strategies and approaches towards disease elimination. And we have four priority diseases. They are lymphatic filariasis, onchocerciasis, which is also known as river blindness, polio, and malaria. And while we have those priority diseases, our work more broadly looks at a class of diseases called neglected tropical diseases. And then even more broadly than that, we look at opportunities within the health system or the global health kind of architecture that would allow for more innovation for, let's say, diagnostics or medicines and treatments to help countries, help communities who are afflicted by these really devastating diseases. The World Health Organization lists 20 diseases as neglected tropical diseases. They include, the two that I mentioned, lymphatic filariasis and onchocerciasis. And these are diseases that really plague kind of the most poor people around the world, right? It's folks that are impoverished, that lived in remote areas. These are diseases that are often transmitted through vectors such as black flies or snails or worms, and they often lead to kind of debilitating conditions such as like enlarged limbs or blindness like river blindness suggests, or other stigmatizing conditions. And so, you know, we very much have like the arsenal, like the tools and the talent and the skill to eliminate these diseases, but we often do not have kind of like enough committed and willing individuals with access to resources so that we can get these diseases actually eliminated. The only human disease that we have eliminated is smallpox. And that took like a huge effort, you know, effort between countries and multilateral organizations like the World Bank and the WHO, but also the private sector and communities and civil society. And so we're trying to galvanize all those disparate groups towards the elimination of some of these diseases as well. As technical director, I really have the oversight of our portfolio of work, what we're prioritizing. And I also am very keen on engaging partners from across that kind of landscape of potential public health or global health actors, again, from both the public and the private space. So yeah, it's a privilege. I love working there and I have a great and committed team.
What inspired you to develop a career in public health?
Back when I was growing up, like, people didn't talk about public health so much. They spoke mostly about medicine. And, you know, as a child of Nigerian immigrants, this might be quite cliche. I think it's also similar in other kind of immigrant communities. But there's this push to be like a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, like these very kind of flashy, but also, you know, take a lot of work, like careers. And so I was definitely always going to be a doctor. But I knew very early on that I wanted to do something to give back to Africa because, you know, I'm Nigerian American. I used to go visit my cousins and, you know, have to see like how malaria debilitates a lot of children, a lot of young people, and how, you know, if you kind of look at the larger impact, how it's debilitating our economies. And so I think malaria was like like a big driver. I was like, okay, like how do I get to a place where I can actually combat malaria? And at first, I didn't really understand how to do it through medicine, but I knew that quite a few clinicians also did research. And so I was really going into the direction of being like a clinical researcher. And then I learned about public health. Yeah, like right after my kind of early university degree, I learned that there was like this whole area of like epidemiology and behavioral health science where you can understand kind of the macro elements of human behavior that either protect them from disease or expose them or give them risk of contracting a certain disease. So that was just really eye-opening. And once I heard about public health, I was like, oh, I'm not going back to medicine. So that was quite clear. And then, you know, just throughout my journey, I just have really had the opportunity of becoming a bit more narrowed and looking at, it's now called health security. But before that, it was really about like health system strengthening and developing kind of these early warning surveillance systems so that you understand what's going on in a population before a health emergency comes up. So I've been part of quite a few response teams. So whether it's like meningitis in kind of the Sahel region or Ebola outbreak. I've also been part of kind of like larger avian flu outbreaks when I was at the Centers for Disease Control. Done a lot of training when it comes to like the building blocks of the health system. And I've done a lot of thought leadership when it comes to like, what do health systems need, whether you're in what we call the global south or countries that have more developing economies versus, wealthier countries in the global north. Like no matter where you are, there are gaps in the health system or gaps between like the trust and the relationship between like communities and healthcare professionals. And all of those gaps lead to risk that we really saw those risks really kind of preyed upon during the pandemic. It leads to a risk of, you know, having a lot more death and disability in emergency situations than you need. So I'm really keen on, you know, improving health systems to prevent those that type of devastation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rondo, for sharing that with us. I particularly liked your point about wanting to give back to Africa through public health and through trying to resolve the gaps in the health systems. I just wonder if you'd be able to share with us any challenges that you've faced building your career path in the public health and healthcare sector, and particularly from the perspective of a woman.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges is like lack of mentorship. So public health actually is woman dominated, but it's on very low levels. I think a lot of industries probably have this issue where if you look at a career path, like as a pyramid, like there's like this huge base of women that are working at community health workers and like affiliated clinician positions, like health assistants or nurses, or, you know, even some physicians. But like, as you go higher, higher up to the leadership, it becomes very male dominated. And so it's really difficult to understand how you can kind of climb the leadership ladder if all the leaders are men. Not to say that there are not men who have helped me in my career. There are a lot of men who helped me in my career. But I think everybody knows that representation matters. And if you don't see women there, especially like Black women or African women, then it's very, you just have a different belief about what's possible. So I would say, like, first and foremost, especially in the earlier parts of my career, the most challenging part was not having those like dynamic female mentors that I had access to. As I've gotten higher in my career, I actually have been able to have access to more of those women. There are not many of us, I have to say, but especially in the kind of African women space, but they are there. And I've been really blessed with having like a good mentor. Like my mentor right now is a lady called Ebere Okereke, and Dr. Okereke, she is the incoming president for the African Public Health Foundation. But being close to her, and I got close to her from working with her. Like I was working for her actually, and you know, through that relationship, she became my mentor even after I moved on. So that was really great. I would say another challenge, like specifically for public health emergencies or working in the health security space, again, even more than other parts of public health, it's very male dominated. Because it has a high risk, right? Like I was in Saudi Arabia during the H1N5 outbreak, and that even going there at that time, Saudi Arabia is very different now, but back then it was, again, only the men from Centers for Disease Control were really going. I was the only person, only woman there that was working on that outbreak. And very interesting, like I kind of threw a wrench in all of their plans. Like back then in Saudi, if you had a woman in your company, like if you're going to a restaurant in company, I mean, like just a group of people going out, then you have to sit in the family section. But if it were all men, you could sit in like what they call the single section. And so I could see like the frustration in people's eyes when I wanted to go out to dinner with them, because that would mean they would have to sit in the family section where there's like crying children. And yeah, it was just a very different experience, right? So then I would feel like a burden if I went out with them. So that's like one example. And yeah, I think that like some of the kind of conditions of the work that we do. So like, you know, being in the field, quote unquote field for weeks at a time, trying to do kind of in the job training with clinicians at different levels of the health system. I think that anybody can do it. I don't think it's a male or a female thing, but I think it's very challenging, especially it's challenging full stop, because you're away from your family and your friends for a very long period of time. You're in places that there's not electricity, and there's like it's very difficult to like easily go to the toilet sometimes. But then as a woman, there's also you're in places that are not necessarily as liberal as the places that you may live, right? Like in the West. And so there's like an added burden of having to like authenticate yourself as a professional or trying to seem credible. Like there's always a bit of a barrier when you're talking to folks that you're trying to support. And that's like because of society, and that's because of culture and all those other things. And so I would say like those are kind of the challenges that I've faced. And I think that they've really shaped me, because knowing that I am very keen on being a mentor, especially for women in the earlier parts of their career. And I'm keen on being accessible as much as I can. But also trying to like encourage others to be, because it's not just me. A lot of people are doing this as well. But I think we need many, many more women mentors. I don't think we have enough in public health.
Thank you, Dr. Arondu. I really like your point about accessibility and just female representation in senior executive positions of the public health sector. It really links nicely to what Yemi Kerry, the CEO of Hekabela, was discussing with us on our previous episode, but specifically focused on the tech sector and the link between education and just women in STEM in general, and how just even in the classroom, having that sort of female representation in the early stages of life in STEM subjects is really crucial. And I like that you touched on that there as well, with the lack of mentorship and now you wanting to be an accessible mentor for those other young women starting out their careers in public health. Could you share your thoughts with us about whether you think the predominant global health architecture supports African institutions?
Yeah. I like this question, because it's something I think about a lot. And if I can just back up and give a little bit more information to the listener, when we talk about like the global health architecture, it is like a very complex system and systems of multilateral organizations. So meaning like, for example, United Nations organizations that support many countries, but as well as bilateral relationships. So that could be like the US or the UK having a relationship directly with Senegal or Indonesia. But then even with that, there's like kind of compacts of like, you know, the EU and the African Union and kind of regional organizations. And that's, it's not also just health focused institutions. There's also like regional economic communities. So like in Africa, there's like ECOWAS, which is the kind of this economic community of Western African states. And then there's SADC in the Southern African development space. And so it's just a really complex web of institutions and communities and NGOs, of course. And then there's like, you know, larger players like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and then just really small players like civil society organizations in Zimbabwe or in India. And so it's really complex. But, you know, the point of the Global Health Architecture, if you look at the leading institution, which is the WHO, is health for all. It really is health for all. And how do we achieve that? And what are the blocks to achieving that, right? Like, is it like out-of-pocket expenses being too high? Is it the lack of appropriate medicines for different regions across the world? Is it decision-making being made by the global north and not by, you know, the entire world? Is it, you know, just folks in America saying like this and this and this is what should happen in places like Peru or like Nigeria. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about the global health architecture. So it's very difficult for me to make a very kind of generic answer to the question, but I'll say yes and no, right? I believe in globalization. I believe in partnership. I believe in exchanging of ideas. And in some ways, in all ways, global health should be that. It should be an exchange of ideas. I think that, you know, when the world comes together and decides to do something, that we're usually successful. And I've seen that in, like, you know, I've talked already about smallpox, but there's kind of a lot of smaller examples about just like very specific goals. Like when it came to making HIV medications affordable for everybody that's suffering with it, not just the people in the global north, like advocates and activists from around the world came together to make that happen. You know, so I think that global health can be very good for Africa in that way, because most of the people, like the actual HIV epidemic happening right now, is happening in Africa. And so like that benefited Africans so much, right? I think when we look at like specific challenges like tuberculosis and malaria, I think that there's a lot of effort from a lot of organizations. So for example, like the Global Fund or like the President's Malaria Initiative out of USAID that do benefit Africa. But I think that there are, because of the complexity of things, I think that not just because of the complexity of things, because of the kind of the hegemony of, you know, wealthy countries, there's a lot of things that are done in the name of helping and the name of global health, but they're really just self, they're self-supporting, like meaning that like if some money is coming out of America to get to Africa for aid or for like development or for global health, about 60% of that stays in America, and it actually funds this kind of like American aid machine that benefits from, you know, there being malaria on the continent that benefits from, like, you know, HIV being there. And it's not saying that they want it to be there. It's just that if we eliminate HIV, if we are able to actually eliminate all of malaria, then where do those jobs go? So I think that there's a perverse incentive from a lot of wealthy countries in the way that global health is currently set up. And I think that does not benefit Africa. I also think, you know, a lot of kind of data understanding of what's going on in global health, it comes from research, right? And that's my kind of area of expertise. I was a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I'm an adjunct professor at Georgetown Law University in the space of health policy. And a lot of what they used to call tropical health institutes, but now we talk about them in regards to global public health, a lot of those systems were built on kind of it's like a colonial relic, right? Like tropical medicine was actually put in place to investigate what was killing the colonizers, right? The folks that were coming from Britain and coming from Belgium and coming from France and, you know, oppressing entire communities in countries. Well, they weren't countries then, but they were dying of like yellow fever and malaria, and tropical medicine really came out of that. And, you know, at first, like the subjects were kind of experimented on, but then they became part of like certain companies, and they were also provided kind of security and protection through the different discoveries that came out of tropical medicine. And again, it's one of those tricky things where, like, again, discoveries came out of tropical medicine, us understanding how malaria spreads, and then thinking about, like, you know, quinine and what can actually be used to protect people from malaria. But at the same time, the way that information was given, or sorry, was obtained, was a very extractive, inhumane, not dignity or human rights centered way. And a lot of those things, a lot of those approaches are being continued even in 2023. And I do not think that benefits Africa. So you know, like there's a lot of challenges to the global health architecture. I would say excitingly, it seems that, you know, African institutions and especially at the regional level, at the African Union level, Africa CDC level, are, you know, really demanding something called a new public health order, which is really about agency, really about, you know, Africa charting its own way with partners, but not at the behest of partners. And so I'm excited about that. That's a new thing that has really happened since COVID, and I'm looking forward to see where that goes.
Those are some incredibly interesting insights, Dr. Irondu. Thank you for sharing that with us. Just touching on your last point about the African Union demanding a new public health order, I wonder if you could just discuss whether there are any socioeconomic benefits of investing in women's health in light of this new public health order in Africa.
So women really are kind of the first node of a community. And to me, they're the fulcrum of like a well-balanced and a well, well-balanced society. I mean, I think there's so much evidence that talks about like when you invest in women, you invest in like an entire society. And so I don't think I need to reiterate that. But I do think that women's health, one, globally being so poorly invested in for so long, it should be a priority in Africa, because there's an opportunity to understand more about women's health due to just the amount of women in Africa that need support for like maybe diseases and conditions that we're not seeing as much in the West, I would say. So I think it's a real I think it's very important for like research and clinical trials to really include African women in these type of studies so that we can understand more for African women, so that we can understand like and identify like what specific conditions and challenges are kind of affecting their sexual reproductive health, but also other parts of a woman as well. But going on to sexual reproductive health, I think that that's also a very important area for us to invest more in when it comes to women in Africa, because there are still quite a few countries that have very kind of anti-women laws in place or laws in place that really restrict the rights of a woman to make her own decisions. And so I think sexual reproductive health justice is a very important space for us to invest in. And that awareness, and that awareness, I think, needs to be increased in women across Africa, but also with men. I think a lot of like the societies and the cultures in Africa, well, the way that they are manifesting now, there's a lot of oppression of women. And through that oppression of women, we actually are seeing more like diseases being spread. So for example, like if a disease can be spread sexually or by contact or by fluids, like in a woman doesn't have many options or choice in who she has sexual relations with, you know, that's how we're seeing like the propagation of certain epidemics, including HIV. So knowing that if you educate women about their rights and their ability to say no about to unwanted sexual advances, that really helps a lot. But you can't really do that without educating men. So I think there's so many different areas in women's health that need to include men for us to really see something go forward. And I think, you know, a big part of investing in women's health is investing in women health professionals, right? Like women clinicians and women who lead hospitals, who are like the executive directors of hospitals, because they're going to think more about like what a pregnant woman needs, you know, when she gets to the hospital, like, you know, what policies are in place that don't make sense for kind of young girls to be seen by certain doctors at certain times, right? What policies in place are actually creating femicide in some countries versus others? So I think that investing in women's health really would improve the entire society, as well as, you know, just reduce the amount of diseases, conditions, debilitating conditions and early death that we see throughout the community, but especially amongst women.
So it truly is some sort of symbiotic relationship between private sector investment within healthcare and also public sector reform on general public health policy regionally in Africa, and also on the global level as well, talking about the global healthcare architecture to support global healthcare, but also African healthcare institutions. So just to close on today's episode, I know you touched on it briefly already, but how does investing in stronger health systems in Africa help women's health in general?
I think it goes back to kind of the last answer that I gave. You know, like when you think of health systems, I always say, think of like people, processes, and products, right? So like the people, like who is there? Like, you know, women actually, if you look at community health workers, women make up most community health workers, and not just in Africa, across the world, but community health workers at the moment, there is no, in most countries across Africa, there is no formal way to include them in the health system, which means they don't get paid for a lot that they do, even though they put their lives at risk. Like if you think about COVID-19 or Ebola, like, or malaria or HIV, it's community health workers that are, you know, kind of the link between the formal health system and the community. And it's crazy to not even pay an entire cadre of women, but that's what we do. Because it's mostly women. And believe me, if community health workers were mostly men, I don't think we would have the same situation, the same issue. But then there also, just to add, there is a layer of injustice due to poverty. Like, a lot of community health workers are folks that come from the community. They're not, you know, doctors and like business folks from like the middle of like, you know, Nairobi or Abuja or Cape Town or Johannesburg. So I think there's also like that intersectional element of poverty as well as gender. So, you know, investing in community health workers ensures that people that live, you know, 15 miles, 20 miles, or if you can convert that into kilometers away from the health clinic, that they're able to still get the help that they need, especially when it comes to kind of childhood illness and just having, you know, paracetamol or like just easily administered medication available. That could be the difference between life and death. So that's an example of investing in a health system component. If you're talking about like products, again, like, you know, if we think about like menstruation and menstrual justice, there are girls across Africa that like drop out of school when they get their first menses, you know, and it's because there are not products available for that. And again, lack of leadership by women. This is a big gap, you know, a big gap, I would say, in most societies across Africa, or in many at least. And so I think, you know, not having products such as that is it's hurting women. It's hurting societies, because we're not having educated women that are able to, you know, add to the economy and also support their families. And if you're talking about processes, thinking about like some of the larger, if you go back to the global health architecture and like some of, like, let's talk about like the current pandemic treaty that's being assessed right now. And the whole point of the treaty is to say, okay, for the next pandemic, we're not going to be, we don't want to repeat the things that we saw, such as like vaccine apartheid, people in the West having access to the vaccine earlier, being on their second, third, fourth, fifth booster, while the percentage of people who were actually vaccinated in Africa was still at that, you know, at some point like 1%, 5%, you know, 10%. And so leaving entire groups of people at risk to die from something that we actually have a vaccine for, we don't want to do that anymore. Like, what type of agreements are we going to go into through this treaty process? If women aren't at the table there, if they're not speaking, if they're not leading these conversations, then we're also going to miss the fact that, you know, when people had to shelter in place or be stuck in their homes and not go out, domestic violence increased across Africa, but also across England, across the US. You know, if you think about systems, or if you look at the Ebola outbreak and how health systems shut down during that outbreak, you know, people died in childbirth because they weren't able to go to clinics. More people died from, if you look at, you know, not getting access to malaria treatment and the malaria diagnosis, as well as TB, more people died from those than from Ebola during that outbreak. And then if you think about like teenage pregnancy or unwanted advances, like a lot of teenagers got pregnant during the COVID outbreak because they were stuck at home and unable to go to school. And so without having women at the table leading these conversations, you're going to miss out on very important issues that have to do with global health, but really are exacerbated when you look at it through a gender lens. So yeah, I think, you know, to answer your question, like there are many parts of the health system. If you look at it in products, processes, and people, you have to realize that gender has to be prominent and women have to be at the table.
Thank you so much, Dr. Arondu, for taking the time to share your insights with us today about public health, and particularly in relation to women in Africa. It's been really great speaking with you, and thank you for sharing the challenges that you continue to address. And we look forward to following your journey of changing the narrative for public health, both in Africa and beyond. So thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. I appreciate this invitation by Invest Africa.